Okay, so I still, I can't adopt the minutes until I get two more people.
He needs another senator.
Well, we've got Lynch.
I'm Mary.
We'll get the litigation update first. So.
Oh, he's got Lynch.
Okay, good morning. I'll call to order the meeting of the Legislative Commission of Pension and Retirement for Wednesday, August 11th, 2010. We don't yet have an administrative quorum. One of the items on our agenda was an update on the litigation relating to the 2010 Omnibus Retirement Bill. After the bill was signed into law, there was a lawsuit filed. I just thought for the benefit of the commission members, we should get an idea of what the issues are in there, what the status is. Obviously, not get into the strategy or any attorney-client information that goes on, but just for some background information benefit, I asked the Attorney General's office if they would come forward and just tell us what's going on so we know the details. Welcome to the commission. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Assistant Attorney General Carla Heil. As you are well aware, the day after the 2010 Omnibus Pension Bill was signed, there was a lawsuit challenging the COLA changes in there. It was a class action lawsuit against PERA, TRA, MSRS, the state, and various named individuals such as the executive directors, the chairs of the pension funds, and the governor. And this law firm, there's a law firm out of Pittsburgh, and they also have local counsel in Minnesota. They had previously sued the state of Colorado with their pension changes. That motion to dismiss is still pending in Colorado State Court. After they sued the state of Minnesota, they are also suing the state of Michigan and the state of South Dakota. To date, they have filed an amended complaint. We have filed our answer. We filed our answer at the end of July. If you want either of those documents, we have provided them to the Pension Commission, and I'm sure that they would be able to make those available to you. The claims in the lawsuit specifically against the state of Minnesota's actions, as I said, it's just challenging the changes to the cost of living adjustment, and claims include that the change is unconstitutional because it violates the Minnesota Contract Clause and the United States Constitution's Contract Clause, that the change is a constitutional taking under Minnesota and federal law, and then also there are Section 1983 that is violation of the civil rights. Against the individual named people, the pension directors and the governor and the chairs of the pension funds. We have moved for dismissal under a summary judgment, so it will be based on pleadings and various attachments to have the whole case dismissed, every count, and also the class action. That hearing will be September 15th in Ramsey County District Court before Judge Greg Johnson. Our papers, our motion papers, and all the exhibits will be due August 18th. So after we file that, that will be public, and we will make that available to the Pension Commission staff also. So with that, if there are any limited questions that I could answer, as the chair said, we don't want to discuss attorney-client privilege or our theory, but I would be happy to answer questions that I could.
Just so I understand what their claim is, they're saying that we've put in statute what cost of living increases are, and this past year with the bill that was passed, we just, instead of paying the level that we're at, we lowered them, and they're saying they've got a constitutional right to keep them, keep building up the way that they had been in statute. Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair. What they are alleging is that they have a constitutional right to the COLA that was in effect when they retired, essentially. And the legislature has changed the cost of living adjustment throughout the years, depending on various circumstances. But their whole claim is that once a COLA has been in place, that that COLA cannot change, essentially.
Okay. And we didn't lower, I mean, we lowered the rate of increase. Instead of it going up to a couple of percentage points, we just didn't go as high as it was. So they were saying that this was an expected cost of living increase. They didn't get the full amount, and that they had a constitutional right to get the full amount, apparently. That's their claim, apparently? Okay. Okay.
That is close enough.
Sure. Representative Kahn?
Yes. What bearing
Mike.
Mr. Chairman.
Microphone.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. What bearing does the Colorado case have on ours? Are the pleadings and the motions for dismissal and that sort of thing essentially the same? Or and what do you think, assuming since when, and I guess when was that filed? I assume it's significantly ahead of ours.
It was filed. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, first, the lawsuits are similar in Colorado, Minnesota, and the other two states in that they're challenging the constitutionality basically on a contract clause constitutional claim that this is promised forever and the states can never change the COLA. Now, Minnesota, as I said, we moved for summary judgment and our hearing is September 15th. We anticipate a decision within 90 days in our district court. My understanding under the Colorado case, they filed for a motion to dismiss on many of their claims, but not all of them. In Colorado, the district courts have no time limitations to make a decision. Therefore, it might be done before ours, it might not. To the extent that there is the Colorado law suit out there, and the others, it really doesn't have any impact on ours because Minnesota statutes are presumed constitutional. Our pension funds are structured differently. Our statutes are all different. So in our decision will be based on Minnesota law. So even though there are similarities in the pleadings, our lawsuit should stand on its own merits.
And Ms. Howell, obviously each state has its own constitution. Did you say that they're suing under the federal constitution as well as the state constitution? Is that what they're...
That is correct. They're also suing under the federal, which they would have to bring the 1983 claim.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Again, this is just some background information for Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Howell, did you say that the same people are suing in those four states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the main lawsuit, it's a class action lawsuit, is out of Pittsburgh, and they would have local counsel in each of the states to assist them. But it is the same lawsuit that has signed the pleadings.
So Ms. Heil, are they claiming the same class in multiple states as opposed to a class of Minnesotans? I'm not quite sure which class they're referring to.
Mr. Chairman, the class in Minnesota is just particular to Minnesota.
Okay.
But this is a law firm that represents a class action lawsuit.
So multiple classes from each state is what you're talking about. I see. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions on the status of that? Okay. Thank you again. We just wanted to kind of get up to speed on it. We do have an administrative quorum, so let's move to the approval of the prior commission minutes of July 8th, 2010. Representative Murphy moves adoption of the minutes. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Last month, we had the commission actuary meet with us, and we approved changes in actuarial standards. And
we didn't
approve them. We consider them. We do have we were provided one document last month that actually changes the standards under which the funds are to be implementing those standards. Now, some of the items in the document are purely technical. I mean, they refer to the Minneapolis Teachers Fund, which doesn't exist anymore, and some other matters. Others are a bit more substantive. The funds last month had not had the opportunity to talk to their own actuaries on this, and so you've got two documents, and one says updated June 1st, 2010. That was the document we had last month. Then there is one that's updated August 2010, and that, I believe, is a response to the fund actuaries' talking to the commission actuaries, Milliman, Mercer and Milliman. So, Mr. Martin, you've presented a – you've got a summary here that there's a lot of changes. I think some are technical, some are significant. Could, rather than go through each item, though, could you just kind of give us an idea of what the significant items are here, and then we'll hear from the funds, too, Mr. Martin.
Okay. Members, to give you some background, in 1984, the legislature was concerned about the quality of actuarial work, and one of the things that the 84 legislature did was to mandate the Pension Commission to establish actuarial standards for actuarial work. We have updated those standards several times over the years, but they had not been updated for about 5 or 6 years before Milliman was given the assignment to review them and to revise them, to recommend our revisions to you. That project was undertaken, and they reported back at the July meeting. Milliman has circulated their work product to the other actuaries, the other pension funds, over time with their work on actuarial evaluations and experience studies. Unbeknownst to us as staff, they did not circulate their work on the standards to the pension funds or to the other actuaries involved prior to the July meeting, which led to some of the confusion last month in that the funds were suggesting that they needed more time to look at the proposed changes. So there was a slight miscommunication problem on this topic. The funds committed to a fairly short timeline in consulting with their actuaries and to assemble some response or to raise whatever issues they might have with the Milliman proposals. That consultation finally occurred late last week, and it ended up resulting in Mercer, which is the pension actuarial firm that represents the three major funds, putting together what they thought was a consensus of what was agreed during a telephone conversation between the actuaries and the pension fund administrators and Milliman. And Milliman, on the following day, putting together their version of what they thought the consensus was. The memo that I have on short paper dated August 9th is an attempt to summarize the points of contention between Mercer and Milliman in those two documents, and then to, for the bulk of the memo, just lay the suggested changes to the standards proposed by each firm side by side. I'm not sure to what extent there is strong feelings about the various topics here. There are eight differences that are laid side by side for you in this memo. We assumed that this would be a technical issue, and so we did not invite, for cost reasons, Milliman back to make a formal presentation to you at this meeting, presuming that this could be done without done on a actuary-to-actuary level, which didn't happen. I've had some discussions with Mr. Bergstrom representing the fund directors, and apparently they have a limited or modest number of concerns with what Milliman is now proposing. And maybe at this point it may be a good idea to hear from the fund directors to get some clarity from them as to just how many of these differences are still at issue before dragging you through the particulars of them.
And one of the reasons why we gave a month was so the actuaries could work this out. So we didn't have to. But so the updated August 2010 one, is that the proposal from Milliman? Is that what we have before us?
Yes.
And so there may be some issues that the funds have within what Milliman was proposing. Okay. Mr. Bergstrom and Ms. Vanek, Ms. Hacking.
I'll take the lead here. Laurie Hacking with TRA. Actually, we are in really total agreement with the August 1st version and don't really have any major issues. We had just one issue that we'd like to
clarify with you, and it has to do with the doing cost estimates for legislative proposals. That's really the only issue we wanted to engage in some discussion with you about.
And as my understanding is, I mean, if we're talking about, say, benefit increases, obviously if it affects one of your three major funds, certainly that's something you can handle. I think the concern is if it's a benefit increase that does not include one of your funds but includes somebody else, who picks up the tab for that? Should that be our actuary? Should it be your actuary? Who pays ultimately? Because somebody's going to have to cost it out. Is that the issue?
I think the issue, Mr. Chair, the issue is the way the standards currently read, and I think have read for a long time, is that really cost estimates have to be done on all bills introduced. Mm-hmm. And typically we have not done that because obviously there are a lot of bills introduced, but there are only a few that get the focused attention by the Pension Commission. So our practice has been those bills that do get focused attention have a hearing and you're actually contemplating taking some action on. We have been providing cost estimates when you've requested that. Similarly, if the pension funds, like in the last year, make proposals, we cost those out as well. So I think we just want to be able to limit the number that we do because, quite frankly, the cost of these runs in the thousands of dollars per estimate. And we typically budget somewhere in the range of six to eight estimates per year. We try not to do more than that because they are expensive. So that's really the conversation we'd like to engage in to ask your understanding of what you mean by this, and hopefully you would agree with us that this would be limited to only bills that are seriously considered by the commission.
And members, if you look at the memo from Mr. Martin on page 13, the last page, you can see in the right column the language that Milliman is proposing. And on the left side, that's what the fund actuaries are proposing as an alternative. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Bergstrom, okay. So, okay. Mr. Bergstrom, Mr. Vanek, did you have anything else to add here to us?
Mr. Chair, not significantly. I guess what our concern would be with Milliman's proposal is that it really allows any entity that any bill gets introduced, we would then have to bear the costs of doing that cost estimate at a cost of $8,000 to $10,000 a piece. And there have been proposals to increase membership in retirement plans or add new retirement plans, and we just want to limit our exposure to those costs.
Okay, so as I read it, okay, on the Milliman proposal is said that a statement of fiscal impact must be completed for each legislative proposal submitted by any entity introduced as a bill that would affect the cost of benefits. Mercer says that a statement must be completed for each legislative proposal submitted by the plan. So if the plan submits a proposal, the plan incurs the cost. Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Correct.
And that's the first part. And then the supplementary information says that the fiscal impact for any legislative proposal submitted for introduction shall include the cost, whereas you're saying
they're identical.
So C is identical in both. It's just Roman numeral 7A is different. That's the difference between the two. Okay, gotcha. But and you're saying that pretty much everything else that we have in the updated August 1st, 2010. Is doable from what Milliman is proposing, but that's the one area that you have concerns about. Okay, I think we focused it down. Okay. Members, what do you want to do? Yeah, anybody else who's here wants to be heard on this?
Sorry,
does anybody want to go forward? Okay, we do have a letter that's being listed.
And Mr. Chair,
Capper, did you want to weigh in? Or
if I could just if I could just clarify, sure. When it says Mercer, those aren't necessarily Mercer's proposal. That's because the funds were involved in that decision as well. They'd probably love to do all these studies.
Yeah.
You know, so I just want to clarify.
Mr. Kapler, we're getting a letter that's being distributed. We're just looking at it now. Did you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Phil Kapler, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. And I'm sorry, staff didn't have our input, more thorough review earlier than this, and I apologize for that. I think, thankfully, the number of points that we would make or items we'd like you to consider in modifying the standards are few. So maybe that exonerates me. I don't know. On pages 14 and 15.
Well, wait a minute. Let's focus on the issue that we're on right now. I mean, maybe you've got some other things in here on this, but I don't want to jump around this whole packet here. I want to just focus on the one issue, and then if you've got other things you want to talk about, we'll get to that.
On the costing issue, I think we're in concert with the statewide funds.
Okay. Let me just pose a question here to the funds. I mean, suppose the Pension Commission is seriously looking at an issue that's going to have some cost to you got to cost out the benefit increases, but it isn't one of your three funds. It's somebody else out there. Who's going to do it? How do we pay for it? Should that be Commission actuary? How do we figure out who that does? I mean, guide me through that. Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. I can just give you an example of a recent situation that PERA was involved in. The County Probation Officers Association is interested in having an earlier retirement age provision added to our coordinated plan. When that bill was introduced, specifically, it was introduced, but it was talked about, it was drafted. And what we told them is that they would have to pay for the actuarial work to support what they were asking for. They, in fact, did that. They got the money together. At the time, that cost study was about $8,000. With the new requirements and the standards, it would be more than that. So we would still support the idea that if it's a select group asking for special treatment, perhaps we consider that they fund the cost of that study. Otherwise, our entire coordinated membership would be supporting the cost of funding that study when it only would affect a limited number of them.
At some, we have a limited amount of time during a legislative session. If all of a sudden some issue comes on up and we're seriously looking at it, and nobody's done the cost analysis, that almost would preclude us from probably doing anything during that session. I mean, so somebody has to do some work ahead of time if they're serious about coming to us with a proposal. So should the rule be that anybody who comes before us, has to figure that those numbers out, whether it's your fund or so? I mean, somebody has to figure that out if they're going to give us the proposal, so we know whether it makes sense or not. I'm just trying to. What's the best way for us to handle something like that?
Ms. Vanek. Mr. Chair, my opinion would be that would be a requirement. You can't introduce a bill unless you pay for an
actuarial study.
And there are means to do that through our systems by using our consulting actuary to prepare the work. But the organization or the group that's interested, if it's not something supported by our boards, would actually the work. That's how we've been handling those thus far.
Okay.
We might do that.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering on a related subject, and I'm not sure that this broad, this applies on something specific or individual like a constituent issue bill, but it seems like it's a similar principle that comes up often with someone wants to do something, and then when they find out what the actual cost would be to pay for it, it turns out that it's not really cost-effective for them to do that, even though we've heard the bill, and yet it's not really cost-effective to do the analysis. it's just kind of a catch-22 situation you sometimes have when you have a constituent issue and they're wanting you to carry it forward, but you don't really know what the cost is going to be for them to do that until after the fact. And again, it's not exactly the same issue, but it seems like somewhat of a related issue.
Well, it's been, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's been my understanding that as we get those single person, even a very small group ones, those are things the funds, whatever the fund can usually kind of figure out. I mean, if somebody comes on in and wants to buy back some time or they want to change something, the funds can usually figure out here's what the cost would be. We're usually talking here about larger groups. I mean, if we decide to give a cost of living increase, somebody's got to figure out what the cost is going to be, and that's going to be a little bit different from just a few individuals. Is that correct, Mr. Bergstrom?
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. On the individual bills, we can do an analysis. It's when it gets a little broader and bigger then we have this issue, because you know, let's say there were 10 different proposals, and we would have to pay for each of those. You can run up quite a tab. So it's, we just have to have some mechanism to control the process.
Help me out, Mr. Martin. Do you have any thoughts? I mean, again, if we get a lot of proposals for requests, some that initiate with the funds and some not. I can understand if the fund is going to initiate something, they'll pay for it and come in with us. But what happens when we have all these other requests coming in? Do we just say no? You haven't costed it out, or any guidance here? Hate to throw it in your lap, but you've been around longer, so.
Members, this is a common problem with legislatures all over. Mm-hmm. I once served for the Pennsylvania Pension Commission. One of the primary reasons for creating the Pennsylvania Pension Commission was to handle this very issue, to provide a mechanism to have an actuarial note, the actual cost estimate for pending benefit changes, presented to the legislature in a timely fashion. It's one of the functions of that commission. They also gave us a relatively modest budget, and we had the same problems that everyone else has of trying to accommodate a large potential demand with a very modest budget. Historically, what we've done here, the standards once were a document that essentially regulated the commission's actuary. The 1984 legislation that required that the standards be created also created the commission actuary as the production actuary. So it was a little clearer whenever the standards required something to happen, who is going to be doing it. It was going to be the one actuarial firm retained by the pension commission. We now are in a little different scenario where we no longer do it that way, and the standards have not been fully accommodating that difference in who the source for the actuarial work has been done. So what we've done historically doesn't necessarily apply. It's always going to be a policy issue what the actuarial cost of any benefit improvement or any benefit change is going to be. And if there is no information on the actuarial cost, that would be the policy issue. Here is a benefit proposal that has no actuarial costing for it, and it would be a reason for you not to pursue the bill further if this was a bill brought in by someone other than on the pension commission. If it's something that the commission wants to do, but no cost is provided by the actuarial or by the actuary retained by the various pension funds, perhaps because it's a proposal that they don't support, they may actually oppose, then presumably the way to resolve that would be to have the pension commission actuary do it if the actuary is in a position to do it. Milliman will be doing actuarial valuations of some but not all of the pension plans for this upcoming cycle. They'll be doing MSRS and PERA General primarily in their first round of replicating the actuarial work. So they would be in a position, they would have all of the data that they need to actually do some actuarial work if need be for any plan that they've done some replication work for. But because of budgetary concerns, we're doing the replication work over a three-year period, portions of the plans each year. So we're going to have some difficulty having the pension commission actuary do an actuarial costing. The actuary for the pension fund involved would still be the optimal place to have the actuarial costing done.
The problem that I see here is the fact that, I mean, Milliman's proposal says we got to get a cost analysis of any bill that's introduced, which doesn't seem logical to me. I mean, because there's a lot of bills that get introduced that are just never going to go anywhere. But then the Mercer, or the thing that's under the Mercer column, says that only those items submitted by the plans will be cost analysis, which means that the pension commission is limited to, you know, doing getting cost analysis only on the items submitted by the plans, that we can't even consider anything else, which seems to limit us too much the other way. I can think of one or two options here. We could just say that, you know, anybody who submits a plan has to pay for it, whether it's by the plan or not. I mean, we'd have to modify the language here. Or we could handle it on a case-by-case basis, that if the commission decides to pursue something, it would be a benefit increase, and then we'd have to direct who's going to pay for the cost of it. You know, either our own actuary or the funds, we could direct that. Again, we may not have time during legislative session, you know, to get that numbers back, but I think we need to address it. If we don't go with the minimum proposal of cost analysis of every bill, then what do we do with the things that are beyond what the plans introduced? And so I think that's something we ought to probably figure out where we want to go on that one. So, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I wonder if you could have like a combination of the two things that you just suggested. In other words, have a default position, but something that the legislature could override if it chose to do something. I mean, make sure we have the latitude to do something we want to do, but perhaps in the absence of our doing something, a way that it would normally be handled so that we don't have things held up just for during session.
Well, these are standards. I mean, if we ignore them, you know, we're free to do that. I mean, if we lock it in saying this is the way we're going to do it, but if the majority of the pension commission decides to go a different direction, we can always do that.
It's,
I mean,
not
we're not locked in. But we should have the standards out there so everybody at least understands what we're kind of looking for when we set this thing on up. So if we deviate, we do it knowingly as opposed to but we should have the rules of the game ahead of time, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're expressing kind of what I'm thinking here in my head, too, is that I think the Milliman is a little too broad, but I think the other one's too restrictive, because sometime in the future, somebody could say, well, these are the standards, this is what we're going to do, and we're not going to pay for it, and there might be proposals brought forward either by individuals or by different pension plans that are opposing opinion in the pension plan, that they want to look at something that may save money, and if they're saying, well, this is the standard, I think that's just a little too restrictive. But I don't like the minimum either. I think that one's way too broad. It could open us up for having to pay for everything.
Based on your discussion, could I suggest some language just
sure.
to get started?
Go ahead.
Working from the Milliman column on your page 13, perhaps you could say that the LCPR shall direct when a statement of fiscal impact must be completed for legislative proposals, and then strike the rest of that, and then a sentence that would basically say the cost of the fiscal impact should be borne by the entity making the proposal. The pension commission shall designate the actuary to perform the analysis. I don't know if that captures what you're trying to say, but it's at least it's a thought. To
do you have that written down then, or I mean it's scribbled or something? I mean, we could make a copy of it and just have it handed out if we could. Yeah, that's an awesome.
Mr. Chair, maybe I misunderstood what was just said, but I thought the way I was understanding it, that amounted to the kind of the same thing as the person requesting this would always be required to pay for it. And I thought we were saying we wanted to keep a little more latitude and not have it all that, quite that far over to that direction.
Well, as I understood it, and again, maybe that's why we need to see it written out here, but the commission could direct, when we want to have a study done, and we could direct who's going to pay for it too. If I understood the language that you read, but that's why we, as I say, if you've got something scrawled out, we can get it copied and passed out here. So, Representative Murphy.
But if that doesn't cover the, if somebody comes to the plan with an idea, like the case that Ms. Bannock suggested, they said, you have to pay for it, we'll do it, you have to pay for it, and then when it came to us, or when it comes to us, it's going to be all done, rather than the way that we're talking with the language, we would never get anything all done. We would have to, send it back.
Somebody else.
I think that we should make accommodation for getting the idea all done before we hear it.
Well, I mean, an example, just off the, say Education Minnesota wants benefit increases and TRA opposes them. Who pays the cost? Okay. Okay. And then they would do that. Obviously, if TRA agrees with them, then TRA is going to pick up the cost. But if TRA says, no, we don't agree with that, then they're told, okay, go back, pay some actuary, come forward, or else, and then do we even bother looking at it if it hasn't been done?
That's what this would do.
I mean, I do want organizations and groups to plan ahead and not just walk in and dump a bill onto our laps and say, we'd like a benefit increase without any thought about, how it's going to be paid for in the long run. I mean, somebody's got to, if they're serious about it, they got to come up, they got to do some work before it gets to us, I would think. Thoughts? Okay. Representation?
Where else do we ever do that?
Well, we have fiscal notes all the time.
That we pay for.
Are we?
That we pay for.
That we pay for.
Groups coming in don't pay for them.
But the alternative, ultimately, fiscal notes are paid for out of the executive branch because they've got the whole army of people that are going to be doing that at our request. I mean, in a perfect world, we'd have our own staff to do that, but we don't. But now we're dealing with organizations and groups that are wanting to have pension benefits, and there isn't anybody in the executive branch that would normally cost us out. That's why we rely on the actuaries to do it, and we're trying to allocate that out, and I'm just trying to work out the proposals here. So, yeah.
Well, I just want, do we need even need a standard about this? Can't we just kind of proceed?
Well,
why do we need a standard that says one or another? I mean, the legislature will come in, a proposal will come in of Education Minnesota, they'll talk to legislators, and we'll decide if we think it should go forward.
Well, when somebody comes before the Pension Commission and makes a proposal to change benefits, one of the first questions we usually ask is, what's going to be the cost in the long run? So that shouldn't be the first time anybody's thought of it when it gets to this level.
But in my experience in working with groups that have done that, and it's not just Education Minnesota, I mean,
Murph
and Uber, they sit down with the pension plans well in advance of ever coming to us and kind of work through that stuff.
And
Sarah Olson.
And I'm just wondering, Mr. Chair, if a group comes to us and they've done an independent study with their own actuary, is that something we're going to be able to just accept completely anyway? Aren't we going to have the responsibility at some point to have done our own evaluation of that?
Well, that's why we now have our consulting actuary.
Right.
That we can kick their numbers over to our consulting actuary, who's going to charge us, for reviewing it. But at least our consulting actuary didn't do the initial work on it. They're just kind of reviewing it. Does it make sense or not? So there's going to have to be a couple of steps before we finally bless off on it. Sarah Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what we're trying to do is give the plans, the ability to do their homework before they get to the Pension Commission. And I think that's good, but I also think that we don't want to curb or diminish. I think there's going to be continue to be some very difficult conversations, and at some point in time, the commission may need to step forward and say, this might be unattractive or this might be difficult, but yes, we do in fact want this costed out. We do want to look at this. So, and as Representative Thiessen said, maybe we're trying to get too much down in the weeds. The commission needs to have the latitude to be able to direct that proposals be costed out as they deem appropriate.
Well, and again, you've got two different language proposals before us.
I could be some help, maybe.
Pardon me?
I might be some help.
Yeah,
right. Members, in listening to your conversation and picking up on Representative Thiessen and Senator Lynch, I suggested the principal reason why we have anything in the standards about costing out benefit proposals is to make sure we've governed the format, what information you want to see, so it's not done in a chaotic way. It's not somebody doesn't walk in using a different actuarial method with different actuarial assumptions and only gives you half of the picture. So there's a whole item B that you're not seeing here that's the real meat of the standard. My suggestion is just cannibalize, get rid of A, not even worry about who's doing it. Just define what the legislative proposal costing is going to look like, not do what's being proposed in C for either party, because they do talk about who's paying or when it occurs, but just recapture B, current B as new A and current C as new B, and just drop the whole issue of, since it's not really necessary to be in the standards, it was more prefatory always. In the old system, yeah, when we had one actuary.
So, if you go to page 35. Okay.
Of the August version of the standards.
Well, but if you just start with B, it says the fiscal impact statement. You're going to have to still have some language in here to introduce it. A statement of fiscal impact must be completed for every legislative proposal. Considered by LCPR? I mean, if you just have B, it says the fiscal impact statement must include a fiscal impact statement for what? So I think you need a little bit more language than just B, but if B is all, and I'm not sure what the funds think about this. Do would B with a little bit of additional language be what we need? What we need are maybe different things, but I'm interested in your input. So,
Mr. Chair, I think we're comfortable with that approach. You could just simply say the fiscal impact of statement of legislative proposals must contain the following, if that helps. And I think that would be fine with us.
Well, I mean, the heading under Roman numeral 7, cost estimates of legislative proposals. So, again, I think you need a little bit more words in here somewhere. So, Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, this has been crossed out, but I think the current language says a statement of fiscal impact must be completed for each legislative proposal, which would affect the benefits in a retirement plan. And it doesn't say who pays for it or who does. And quite frankly, that's worked. I think we try to play well with others if we can. Cooperate as much as we can. So I think it kind of the current, but I have so many crossouts I can't be sure.
So just you're suggesting the current language without the underlining or the strikeouts or whatever. That means it just says that an impact must be completed. It doesn't say when it's going to be completed or who pays for it. That's the general rule, right?
Right.
It's, we need a statement, and then B would start saying what it's to contain.
Right.
Does that create any issues or problems?
No.
Okay.
Then you would just not do the changes in A and C and just leave the change that is proposed for B, since both actuaries and funds can agree to that.
Okay.
And then we just leave it open-ended for the commission to pursue as we have historically.
And that's worked over the years? Kind of?
Senator, you've been on the commission for a while, has it?
I don't know. Okay. I don't deal with the actuaries firsthand, so I don't know. Okay.
You're the consumers of the information, so we pretty much have had actuarial work when we've done major benefit.
Okay. I get it. Okay. So as far as just changing, we'll have an overall motion to adopt the standards, but Representative Murphy moves on page 35 to, on subparagraph A, to delete the new language and, let's see, do we reinsert the stricken language? Well, just delete anything that's new right there. Is that correct?
For A and for C.
And then on C, delete any of the new language, any stricken language that you have there. So just keep it as is right now. So that's the motion, and we're just amending that part of the document right now. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Okay. Anything else on this topic, anybody? Okay. Okay, Mr. Kepler, you had some other things you want us to take a look at within the standards. Mr. Kepler.
Mr. Chairman, members, two topics, really, and they are sort of specific and narrowly relate to St. Paul. So we don't really have any concerns generally about the directions that the revised standards are going. The first is how to deal with and cost the liabilities for post-retirement increases and to forecast those. And the situation that St. Paul is in is we've been operating under this continued pilot project where the post-retirement increases for retirees are linked to the consumer price index within a band of 0 to 5. And that law is temporary in effect and sunsets after this year. So, I mean, this year that formula would apply, except in the sustainability bill, we suspended the CPI-based adjustment and retirees are going to be getting zero. But that law will go away after this year, too. And remaining out there in statute and the formula that we would revert to if action isn't taken in the 2011 session is the guaranteed 2%, the old guaranteed 2% plus excess investment earnings over the assumed rate of 8.5% on a 5-year annualized basis. So the standards don't really contemplate that scenario for us, and that's what is out there in permanent law if the pilot project isn't codified somehow in the upcoming session. And I think that was sort of the biggest concern of our actuary. I think that's resolved if the first full sentence on page 15 of the August draft were deleted, though if you think that has a more general impact, then that might be something you want to discuss further.
Okay, now this is a part of the current standards, correct?
It is.
Yeah, okay. So if the benefit adjustment is based on the consumer price index, the assumptions used shall be consistent with the inflation. Now, does this sentence reflect current law then, or...?
It reflects the standards that have generally been applicable.
Uh-huh.
But our post-retirement assumption, really we assume the guaranteed 2% now is what we do because that's just a fixed amount that's out there in law. And because we've got an assumed rate of 8.5%, we don't assume we're ever going to beat it. We assume that's going to be the average over time. So the actuary uses a guaranteed 2%, which may or may not be connected to inflation going forward if we revert to the old formula. If instead the legislature decides to codify something closer to the CPI-based adjustment that we're now doing, then I think there's a subsidiary issue, maybe a little broader one, and that is the choice of or the method by which you go about choosing an inflation or applying an inflation assumption to post-retirement increases. The way the standards read now, that assumption should be linked to salary increases, and that's really an active member issue, and investment returns. And those things have always been sort of tethered together to try and keep, I think, maybe too much artistic license or heroic assumptions being applied to inflation that weren't anchored to real economic variables the way that we think that the salary increase assumption is and the investment return assumption is. But I would submit that I think that there are three not necessarily completely unrelated variables, but they're independent of each other, and I don't see that the inflation assumption should be a derivative of what the negotiated salary increases are for the active population. This is opening up a broader issue about which I think you could probably get any number of actuaries to debate with me, and I would not debate with them in public. I might in private on a conceptual level, but to do so in public would require mastery of the craft and art and the lexicon that I do not possess.
I'm a little uncomfortable. I mean, our actuary is the one who submitted these changes. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason why we need to adopt something is because they're starting to work on some of the major funds right now, and they need the guidance from us to do that. That doesn't so much apply to the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I'd really like to have you submit this to Milliman, get their review of it. If they're okay with it, I mean, you know, you're part of the standards, you know, are less critical right now.
Yeah.
So you've got time to do it. And, you know, if we need to adopt the commission needs to adopt it, you know, early next year, the commission is in a position to do that. But I think if we adopt this without having our commission actuary even see these changes, I'm nervous about doing that. So what I would ask you to do is, you know, contact them, run this past them. I wasn't planning this meeting here until last month when we had a delay thing. I'm really not planning another meeting during the rest of this year. If we have to have one, we can deal with it then.
Right.
But I've got some discomfort here, so.
And that issue is sort of broad. I raise it because our actuary sort of reads the standards as sacred script, if you will.
Sure.
And if they have any misgivings about these things or feel uncomfortable applying them verbatim the way they read, they're going to raise it with us.
Understand.
And they did on that particular point. I think that the tethering of the inflation assumption to investment, assumed investment return and salary increases is a much broader sort of topic about modeling that I'm not sure you want to get into now, but I just thought I would.
Yeah,
as long as you're taking up the matter, I thought I'd put it in the record.
Have your actuary contact our actuary, and then they'll talk. Okay.
We will. On the second point, Mr. Chairman, on page 18, this is something that is sort of more concrete and prescriptive, and I'm wondering if the commission wouldn't be willing to consider inserting after the phrase in what's noted there as paragraph 5, including the MRF division of PERA and inserting and the SPTRFA. Rationale for that proposed change is this is language that's talking about setting a new sort of amortization window, 30-year amortization window for a changes that affect benefits and unfunded liabilities and not compressing those within a window that might be the case with a fund that has a fixed date. In St. Paul's case, you've applied a 25-year fixed period amortization, so it's always going out 25 years, and we're not really sort of running the risk that the standards are attempting to address of having liabilities that are kind of intergenerationally not synchronous. Any addition or change to the unfunded liabilities by a benefit proposal or change for St. Paul would be out over the same window of time as the rest of the liabilities for the plan, and so you don't run that risk.
Mr. Martin.
Members, I might be of some help here. What is going on here, the amortization dates are defined by statute. We really could stop this part of the staff, the standards, you look on page 18, this would be item 5. There's a sentence that the amortization date is the date that's in 356, basically. That's what that first sentence says. If we just stopped there, I think we've solved the problem. Because what we're doing is, to some extent, the new language that's being added in 18 is attempting to parrot what the statute currently provides in case of the PERA plans. But there are other plans that have other particular aspects of their amortization date set forth in statute. I think I'm not sure why Milliman suggested putting this in there and why Mercer and Milliman got into it on this issue when it's really governed by statute and statute takes priority over any of the standards. So I think if we just stop with the recitation of the amortization date is as it is in Chapter 356, just stop with that first sentence, I think we're better off. So this would be doing away with all of this.
Okay, so
the full sentence
starting with the word "for"
amortization date.
Yeah. Okay. Amortization date.
You retain and everything else.
And then the language starting "for example." Suppose a plan has a July 1st. So all the way to the end of the page where it's underlined 256.215 subdivision 11 should be a comma 11 or no sub. So everything from that point forward through the end of the page would be stricken, you say, because you say that's not needed. Okay.
Yes, members, okay. Since it's already covered by statute, okay. Having it here is at best just for the convenience of the actuaries and not really governing anymore.
Well, statute's going to govern over the standards anyway. So.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Representative Murphy moves that on page 18, subparagraph 5, the sentence that starts, for example, suppose a plan has a July 1st valuation. That part of that paragraph all the way through the end would be stricken, 356.215 subdivision 11. That whole part would be stricken. Discussion on that motion. Mr. Gappler, would that take care of it?
Mr. Chairman, I think that does, yes.
Okay.
More elegantly than what I was proposing.
On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion fails. Okay, anything else?
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else who wants to be heard on the standards?
Members.
But Mr. Martin, yeah.
Members, two things come to mind. Milliman and Mercer have done a good job of catching most but not all of the statutory cross-reference changes that have occurred. If you would include in your motion a blank or do a separate motion that we can blanket correct any bad statutory references, I think that would help. There are also, in my reading, a couple instances where there are sometimes two verbs and only one subject of a sentence, or parts of words, prepositions have fallen out. There's just some grammatical language usage problems. If you would allow us to without changing the substance, complete a sentence or put in the right verb tense or that sort of language cleanup by a blanket motion, I think that would help.
Mr. Chair, I move those technical changes.
Okay. And your motion would be to adopt the standards as amended. Okay. Representative Murphy moves the adoption of the standards as amended in the updated August 2010 document with the direction to the staff to correct statutory references and correct any grammatical errors. It's discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Anything further? Does anybody else have anything further to come before the Pension Commission? Okay, well, I think we're done.
I thought we were going to talk about the litigation.
We had that before he got here.
Right.
Yeah, it was.
I just had a question that I'd like to ask staff. Having noted that the city of Minneapolis is now pushing a plan of early retirement for policemen as a city money saving issue, is that going to have any effect on the pension funds?
I got nervous. At some point, it seemed to me that almost any time when we have an early retirement plan, it pushes off unanticipated expenses on pension plans. Do you look at that at all or think about it?
Representative Kahn, members, I have only noted in the press that there is some sort of an incentive being proposed by Minneapolis. I don't know the nature of the incentive. I know we have a representative of the city of Minneapolis here who could probably fill us in, because I don't know what the proposal or the program is. I'm not sure I have any way of gauging off the top of my head what the impact would be, and I'm aware of no one doing any formal study of it. But maybe
I think part of Murph's problems was an early retirement incentive plan.
Part of Murph's problem was an early retirement age, not so much an incentive program, but a age 60 or a 30 and out early normal retirement age that was much earlier than other plans. That's definitely true. We do have someone from Minneapolis here who could briefly, I think.
Mr. Ranieri. Welcome to the Pension Commission.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, my name is Gene Ranieri, City of Minneapolis. Unfortunately, I don't have all the details on that proposal. I will get them to Representative Kahn and the Commission within the next couple of days. That's okay with you. I'm just not up to speed on it.
Okay. Anything further? Anybody else got any business to come before us? Okay. Well, thank you. Good luck on your election campaign. See you down the road. Meeting is adjourned.
Good luck on yours, Mr. Chair.
He was pretty happy.